In the last session, we talked about Deuteronomy chapter 15 and how it applied the Sabbath commandment to economic life. The people of God have an obligation not only to rest from their labor, but to bring rest to the lives of those around them. And in Deuteronomy 15, Moses applies that principle specifically to rules about releasing debts and caring for the poor. But the Sabbath isn't just about caring for the poor, nor is it just about rest. The Sabbath is also about gathering together for worship. To quote from our church's catechism, from its answer to the question, how do you keep the Sabbath? The catechism gives this answer: I cease from all unnecessary work, rest physically, mentally, and spiritually, and join with my family and church in worship, fellowship, and works of love. Joining with family and church in worship. Deuteronomy 15 doesn't mention anything about that in its discussion of the Sabbath principle, but the next chapter does. In Deuteronomy 16, Moses turns his attention not to weekly Sabbath practices, but to the three main worship festivals that give structure to Israel's annual calendar. As with most of the laws in Deuteronomy, this isn't the first time that these festivals have been mentioned. In Exodus chapter 23, for instance, when God is speaking to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai, he tells them, "Three times in the year you shall keep a feast to me." And then he goes on to give some instruction as to what those feasts involve. In Leviticus chapter 23, these three feasts are discussed in more detail. And in both of those instances, in both Exodus and Leviticus, the connection between these three main worship feasts and the Sabbath is made abundantly clear. Just as the Sabbath is a weekly day of rest and worship before the Lord, so these festivals are meant to be extended moments of yearly rest and worship. Of course, as Christians, we don't celebrate these festivals. And yet there is still a lot of wisdom in these laws for us today. In what follows, I'd like to begin by looking briefly at what Moses says about these three festivals in Deuteronomy, and then conclude by highlighting some enduring principles and ways that these laws speak not only to ancient Israelites, but to all of God's people everywhere. So first, what exactly are these three festivals? And what does Moses say about them in Deuteronomy 16? If you read Exodus 23, when these feasts are first mentioned, you may notice that they are called by different names than the ones that Moses uses in Deuteronomy. Exodus refers to the Feast of Harvest and the Feast of Ingathering. In Deuteronomy 16, Moses doesn't use those terms, but he instead uses the names that you find in Leviticus: the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Booths. Each of these three festivals have their own distinct instructions and their own distinct rituals, but there are also some common elements that tie the three of them together. First, each of them call for people to cease from their work and to travel to a designated area for communal worship. Moses doesn't specify the precise location. He simply refers to it as the place that the Lord your God will choose. But we do know from later in the biblical story, we know that this is a reference to Jerusalem. So three times a year, the people are required to stop working and they go to Jerusalem. And each of these festivals are occasions to commemorate and to celebrate the blessings of God, both in the past and in the present. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is the first of the three, it takes place in the spring, sometime in March or April, depending on the year. And it's an extension of the Passover. So on the one hand, the festival is it's a remembrance of the Passover and the Exodus. It's a commemoration of God's work in delivering the people out of Egypt. At the same time, this festival also takes place during the very first harvest of the year, which would have been the barley harvest. So even as the people spend a week eating unleavened bread, and remembering the hardship from which they were delivered, when they come together, they're also celebrating the fact that God not only delivered them in the past, but has blessed them with a land and crops in the present. After that comes the Feast of Weeks, or is it sometimes called Pentecost? The word Pentecost comes from the Greek word for 50. And you can see in Deuteronomy where that festival got its name, because the first thing Moses says about it is that it takes place 50 days after the Passover and the barley harvest. You shall count 7 weeks. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time the sickle is first put to the standing grain. And just like the Feast of Unleavened Bread, this feast is both a commemoration of the past and a thankful celebration of present provision. As one Old Testament scholar notes, the Feast of Weeks celebrated the harvest of wheat and the ripening of the first fruit in the land. It also commemorated the giving of the law at Sinai, which took place shortly after the Exodus. And the same thing is true with the third festival that Moses mentions, the Feast of Booths. This was also a harvest festival, and it was perhaps the greatest celebration of the entire year for Israel, coming right on the heels of the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Moses tells the people that they should keep this festival for a full 7 days. For 7 days, they should sleep in small huts or booths by which they could remember their time in the wilderness and how God had provided for them. And then at the end of those 7 days, they were to leave their huts and return home with great celebration, giving thanks for the homes and the crops that God had blessed them with. So you have three festivals, three moments of seasonal harvest, and three great moments of Israel's redemption, the Passover, the law at Sinai, and the wilderness. That's what these festivals were meant to celebrate. But in order to learn from them, we need to go beyond the basic instructions that Moses was giving and ask the question, why? Why were these festivals instituted? What was their purpose? What were their effects? And why now, in Deuteronomy, as the people are preparing to cross the Jordan River into the Promised Land, why now emphasize these festivals? The Jewish scholar Jonathan Sacks, he poses that question in his own writing on this chapter. And I think his answer is very enlightening. Sacks says that one of the reasons that Moses emphasizes these festivals now is because Israel is about to go from a life where they have very little and are daily having to rely on God's provision to a life of prosperity, where they will be building homes and farming their own land. For the last 4 decades, they've learned how to depend on God in a time of need. Now they must learn how to acknowledge and give thanks to God in a time of plenty. And as their own history will confirm, that's not easy. When you're prosperous and secure, it's easy to forget God, to forget your need for Him, and to forget His kindness. As Sacks observes, when Jews had little to thank God for, they thanked Him, prayed to Him, and came to the synagogue and house of study to hear and heed His word. When they had everything to thank Him for, many turned their backs on the synagogue and the house of study. And that is why these festivals are so important. It's why Moses insists that Israel follow them, in telling them to leave their homes 3 times a year and gather together to commemorate these blessings. What Moses was doing, Sacks says, was giving expression to the great paradox of faith. It is easy to speak to God in tears. It is hard to serve God in joy. As we've already seen multiple times in Deuteronomy, Moses is very concerned with the temptations that the Israelites are going to face in prosperity. He worries that they will begin to think that their success comes from their own hard work. He worries that they're going to forget that God is the source of every good thing they enjoy. He worries that they're going to begin turning to other gods for blessing or for protection, because it's easy to pray to God when things are difficult. It's hard to remember to thank God and to serve Him when things are going well. And that's why God institutes these festivals, to help them remember their times of need, to remind them that they depend on Him. At least that's one reason. But there's another lesson that these festivals teach us. They also teach us to rejoice. Did you notice that? It's especially clear with the latter two festivals, the Feast of Weeks and the Feast of Booths. In describing both of them, Moses not only encourages the Israelites to rejoice, he actually commands that they rejoice. First, in reference to the Feast of Weeks, he says, "And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, the Levite who is within your towns, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are among you." And then again, when talking about the Feast of Booths, he says, "You shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your towns." And we talked several sessions ago about the audacity of the command for Israel to love God. But what about this one? Not only must we love, but we also must rejoice. And did you notice that Moses, he doesn't give any qualifiers to that command? He doesn't say, when your harvest is plentiful, and when your children are healthy and you've had a great year, then you are to rejoice. He doesn't say that only those who haven't experienced real loss or only those who have no reason to grieve must rejoice. He just says you must rejoice, and that everyone, regardless of their station or lot in life, regardless of how their year has been, regardless of success or failure, everyone must join in. And that's another thing that stands out about these festivals. They are not private affairs. The first time that the Israelites celebrated the Passover, back when they were still in Egypt, they were told to eat the meal together as families. And maybe if they had more food than they needed, then they could invite some neighbors to join them. But these festivals are very different. They're not private parties. In fact, as Jonathan Sacks points out, the very word that Moses uses here when he commands them to rejoice, the Hebrew word simcha, it is by definition a shared and a collective joy. Joy, happiness, pleasure, and the like are all states of mind, emotions. They belong to the individual. We can feel them alone. Simcha, by contrast, is not a private emotion. It means happiness shared. It is a social state, a predicate of we, not I. There is no such thing as feeling simcha alone. It seems to be a pattern that in moments of difficulty or struggle or need, that those moments often unite a people, whereas prosperity tends to divide us. Recently, a Harvard social scientist named Robert Putnam, he published a book where he talked about this. And he noted that at the end of the 19th century, during the so-called Gilded Age, that period of enormous personal prosperity, he said that Americans tended to think of themselves as individuals. In fact, there's direct evidence for this in the language that they use. If you look at everything that was written during that period, from books to advertisements to newspaper articles, what you'll find is a whole lot of first-person pronouns. A lot of I, me, and mine. And that's very different from what you find 50 years later, after Americans had struggled through a Great Depression and two world wars. People didn't use near as much I, me, and my language. Instead, they spoke about we and us and our. Because they didn't just think about their own happiness, they thought in much bigger terms. In his research, Putnam found that right now, we've once again entered a period of very individualistic feelings. If you look at the language we use today, it seems that in terms of attitude at least, it seems that we're kind of back in the Gilded Age. Because prosperity has a way of doing that to you. It narrows your focus, so you just start thinking about your own personal happiness or you and your family. And God knew that Israel would face a very similar temptation when they entered the Promised Land. So he instituted these festivals, and he told them three times every year that they had to stop working and leave their homes, and they had to remember the one who had blessed them, and that when they came together, that they must rejoice, and not as individuals, and not even as individual families, but as a nation. When they came together, their joy needed to be shared. When we read these words today as Christians, we may feel some distance from them because we don't go to Jerusalem 3 times a year. We don't celebrate these festivals. But that doesn't mean that we don't have something to learn from them. After all, we face the same temptations Israel faced. We too are tempted to forget God, to forget His benefits and blessings. We're tempted to content ourselves with just focusing on our own personal happiness and success. And so we need times like this, scheduled times when we come together for worship, yearly seasons where we remember the great things God has done for us in the past. That's why as Anglicans, it's why we put so much emphasis on observing the Christian calendar. It's why we celebrate and observe seasons like Advent and Lent and Easter and Pentecost. It's not because these are the only times of the year when we should remember how God has redeemed us. It's because, like Israel, we tend to forget. And that's also the reason why we insist on gathering together every week for public worship. Because we need to learn how to give thanks and rejoice in prosperity and in poverty, in times of ease and in times of hardship. And when we come together as God's people, we must learn the meaning of that shared collective joy. We too must heed and obey Moses' words, and you shall rejoice.